Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. This is a Design for Living Big Book meeting of Overeaters Anonymous. My name is Cheryl. I'm a compulsive overeater, and I'm your chairperson for today's meeting. To open the meeting, let us have a moment of quiet meditation, followed by the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. We start this meeting by remembering our common purpose, to extend the heart and hand of the OA Fellowship to those who still suffer. Let us be mindful of OA's unity with diversity policy, which respects our differences, yet unites us in the solution to our common problem. Whatever problem you may have with food, you're welcome at this meeting. Today, we're delighted to have Janet B. joining us to share her experience, strength, and hope, focused on the topic, Two Wives. Welcome, Janet.
Hi, thanks. I know some of you. It's really nice to be back here down under again. So I'm Janet B. I live in North Carolina, over in America, and it is 5:30 p.m. Saturday. So happy to be here, and I really like this topic, Two Wives. It's a chapter that doesn't get much airtime, but we're going to give it some airtime now. So I can't think of too many people who feel more lonely than the wife of an alcoholic, right? Imagine waiting up for him night after night, not knowing when or if he's coming home. And if he does, will he be sullen and silent, or will he be raging and abusive? And imagine if you have kids and you watch your kids learn how to be silent and tiptoe around the house and make themselves small so that daddy doesn't notice them. It's easy to imagine that this wife, even though she may have been a woman of faith all her life, it's easy to imagine her whispering in the dark, God, where are you? Do you even hear me anymore? And then we get to this chapter, Two Wives, where it says, if you have your big book, on page 104, we want to leave you with the feeling no situation is too difficult and no unhappiness too great to overcome. And you can almost feel these wives who've gone before her reaching out to this struggling wife to say, you matter to us. And I believe that if we listen closely to the words in this chapter, we can really hear God saying, and you matter to me. And of course, isn't that what all that we really want to hear? For just a minute, before we get into the meat of this chapter, I want to actually flip back a little to chapter 4, We Agnostics, where they tell us the main object of this book. And they say it's to, quote, enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem, end quote. Well, if this power, this God, is going to enable me to solve my problem, which was binging nonstop, being unable to put the food down, sometimes couldn't even make it to lunch, this God must care about me. He must love me. So it's this God, this loving God who we matter to, who in the next 45 minutes or so we'll try to encounter in the pages of Two Wives. As I said, this chapter generally doesn't get a lot of airplay. Often people skip it saying, well, I'm not married to an alcoholic, so it doesn't apply to me. But I think there are a lot of principles we can apply in our own recovery, because my recovery isn't primarily about food plans and meetings. It's about how I practice spiritual principles in all my affairs. And to someone who's new, that may just sound bizarre, right? When I first came to OA, all I wanted was to stop binging. And of course, the number one thing I wanted was a food plan. It didn't work. 6.5 years in, still binging, even though I was going to meetings. And finally, thank God, someone explained to me that I had to change. I had to have this thing called a spiritual experience. And what is that? Well, page 25 explains it. It's basically where God comes in and rewires my heart. I mean, how does that happen? Do I just say a prayer and God comes in with cosmic gardening tools? No, tried that. It didn't work. What does work is this 12-step program, which tells me I need to get a concept of God that makes sense. I need to surrender my entire life to him, clean up my past, and then practice these principles in all my affairs. And of course, there's some basic spiritual principles we have to start practicing right away if we want a spiritual experience, like honesty. If we're not honest, it's like we take a big black Sharpie and write the words, "Keep out God," across our hearts. God will not coexist with dishonesty. And by the way, we don't have to wait until we're through the steps to start practicing spiritual principles. Right away, we're told we have to be honest. We have to be unselfish. We have to put spiritual principles to use. And the chapter of Two Wives is chock full of amazing spiritual principles and some wonderful promises for us if we practice them. We don't have time to go through every single principle. So I've picked out the ones that have had meaning to me and that I hope will be helpful. So the first half of the chapter is really about how to help someone who's an addict. And then halfway through, it does this really big switch, like, okay, wife, now let's talk about you and your spiritual issues. So let's dive in on page 104. On the last paragraph there, it says, we want to analyze mistakes we've made. We want to leave you with the feeling that no situation is too difficult and no unhappiness too great to be overcome. And I love that because it's telling me God's going to do one of two things if I surrender to him. He's either going to change my situation or he's going to change me so that I'll be okay in my situation. To me, that's a big demonstration of how much I matter to God. Door number one, he sits at his cosmic computer and reroutes everything so that my situation is changed for the better. Or door number two, he changes my heart. Down at the bottom of page 106, it talks about what happens to an addict as the sprees grow closer together. I can surely relate to that. It says the deepening pall of remorse, depression, and inferiority settled down on our loved ones, and these things terrified and distracted us. Distracted us from what? I know that if I'm overly focused on how another family member is doing, how my kids were doing, that was a big one for me, then I'm distracted from God. So the way I like to think about it now is like I'm swimming in one of those lap pools that has lanes roped off, and I'm swimming toward God. I visualize that. And if I start swimming in another lane, I lose focus on God and doing his will. Other people's recovery and the future are things that are not in my lane. Okay. Top of 107, it says that like animals on a treadmill, we patiently and wearily climbed, falling back in exhaustion after each futile attempt to reach solid ground. And it reminds you of like the little hamster in the cage on that wheelie thing. He's working and working and getting nowhere. And that's how I was in my early days of recovery. I worked really hard and I didn't get anywhere. In fact, my first 6-7 years actually got worse. Even though I was doing a lot of work, I just wasn't doing the right work. It was like being a diabetic and then the doctor telling me to take an antibiotic. And I take the antibiotic. Well, I'm doing the work. I'm doing what I was told, but I haven't been told the right thing. I need a new doctor who gives me correct information. So I guess my caution here is to, if you're new, read this book. And if you're looking for a sponsor, you want to vet your sponsor and make sure that he or she works the steps the way it's outlined in this book so that we get the promises that the book gives us. Okay, continuing on page 107, it says that the wives endured some really hard stuff, watching their husbands go to sanitariums, hospitals, jail. And the wives say, we naturally made mistakes. And that's the second time this chapter uses the word mistakes. And I really like that because most of us tend to fall off the bed, the side of the bed of either being too easy or too hard on ourselves. I was the first type. I'd make a mistake in a difficult situation, like yelling at one of my kids. And afterwards, I'd say, I didn't deal with that situation well. I must be in relapse. I'm in spiritual kindergarten. I'm nowhere. I have no recovery. But they're saying that when things are hard, we're going to make mistakes. And they don't pass judgment on us. And we shouldn't really judge ourselves that way. Yes, we should fix things and say, I was wrong. We don't want to fall off on the bed of the side of enabling ourselves. That's horrible. We won't get anywhere in recovery. Or to use that quote, I'm only human. That's an enabling quote if we use that. If I lose my temper 100% of the time, it's because of me. But it's a mistake. And if I learn from it, I ask God to take me to better things and make my amends, it doesn't make me a bad person, unworthy of God's love. Page 108, the second full paragraph says, try not to condemn your alcoholic husband no matter what he says or does. Remember, he's just another very sick, unreasonable person. So it says, when he angers you, remember he's very ill. So I see two things they're telling me to practice here with difficult people. And again, this could be a husband, but it could be a boss, children. The first thing it says is, don't condemn. Why? Well, I think there's a couple of reasons for that. First, condemning never works, right? Who of us got into recovery because someone said, you know, you're a really bad compulsive eater. You're overweight. You're ruining your life. You're ruining other people's lives. Get your act together. And then we said, oh yeah, thanks. I didn't know that. Thanks for the condemnation. I think I'm going to work a 12-step program and get my act together. Zero of us are here because of that. The other problem is that if I'm condemning someone, it's dangerous for me spiritually, because if I'm condemning you, then I'm at the top of the mountain and guess where you are. And that means I am loaded with pride, and the only place to go if I'm on the top of a mountain full of pride is down. The second thing it says is that when he angers you, remember he's very ill. Remembering, that's a verb. It's an action step I can take to remind myself the person is ill, right? When we're resolving resentments, we say sometimes this person is perhaps spiritually sick. We don't want to overuse that, but sometimes that people are. If I'm living with a raging alcoholic, it's a safe bet that this person is spiritually sick. And I need to have the kind of compassion I would if I were living with someone who had a brain tumor who made them act a certain way. A couple of years ago, I went to pick up my mom for a doctor's appointment. And before I got there, she got all agitated and had someone who was working the front desk of her place call me to see where I was. Now, I was right on time, and I was annoyed at my mom. Like, why'd you have them call me? I'm not late. But a couple of weeks later, she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. So after that, whenever she got agitated or said things that weren't the nicest, I didn't have any annoyance or resentment. I only had compassion because I knew that she was sick. How much more so, right, or equally so, we need to on our fellows who are suffering. And by the way, I think this also holds true when we're sponsoring and people don't do well. We shouldn't be annoyed. We shouldn't berate them. Yes, we hold our boundaries as to what recovery work they need to do, but we're spiritually sick. Okay, they go ahead on the top of page 111. They talk about the four different types of drinkers and the kind of things we can do to help them depending on what type they are. But they give general principles that can be applied to all. They say the first principle of success is to never be angry. Well, that's kind of hard if you've got someone who's drinking or abusive or mentally unstable. But remember, page 66 of our big book tells us we can't harbor resentments. I can't be a safe harbor for resentments. I can't just say, oh, that's okay. This person gets me mad and I'm entitled to wallow in it. What I'm supposed to do is acknowledge I'm angry. I have to acknowledge it. I don't pretend I'm not. But then I have to do something about it. I inventory it. I share it with someone else. I ask God to remove it. And I make my amends. And they end that paragraph, so the first paragraph on page 111, by saying that patience and good temper are most necessary. Because again, it's an illness, a disease we're dealing with, not a moral issue. The second principle they give us is, they say, our next thought is you should never tell him what he must do about his drinking. It's a hard one, right? Never tell someone what they must do about their fill in the blank. The best example I have is my husband. He used to be a smoker, and I did not like that at all. But I never told him what he needed to do about his smoking. All I said was, honey, we have a couple of little kids. So if you're going to keep smoking, we need to take out a large life insurance policy for you. And then I actually asked him, how often can I tell you that I don't like you smoking and ask you to quit? And I think he said once a month. And by the way, he quit about 10 years ago, and it was not because I nagged him. I didn't nag him, but I did get the life insurance because that was a boundary to protect me and my children. The third principle here, it says, be determined that your husband's drinking, or your husband's, or your husband's not doing what you want, your children's refusal to listen to you, your boss is not appreciating you, your fill in the blank is not doing what you want. Be determined that is not going to spoil your life. It says it is possible to have a full and useful life, even though your husband continues to drink, even though your kids continue to whatever, even though your boss does whatever. Our book tells us that our recovery is never dependent on circumstances. It's dependent upon our relationship with God. So if I'm too upset over what someone else is doing, there's a problem with my relationship with God. I would say in my recovery, one of the biggest challenges I had that blocked me from a full and useful life was anger and fear around my kids. Sometimes well-meaning friends would say to me, well, it's normal that you worry about them so much. You're a mom. But I worried so much because my attention was in the wrong place. Here's a prayer that I found that really helped me with my kids. And hopefully it'll be helpful to someone here who may be struggling the same way I did. Lord, I see that I don't really love my children too much. I love you too little in proportion to them. Only if I love you supremely will I love everything else well and properly. Capture my heart. Amen. I pray for God to capture my heart so that I love him supremely, and then I can love everyone else properly. The fourth principle they list here on this page says, do not set your heart on reforming your husband. You may be unable to do so, no matter how hard you try. Remember, this program tells me to live and let live, so I can't set my heart on reforming my husband's smoking, whether my college kids decide to go to church or not, or anyone's drinking, eating, gambling, or how they treat me. Now, if I'm in a dangerous situation or an unhealthy situation, I can always remove myself from the situation, but I don't have a right to tell anyone how to live their life. Unless, of course, when I had small children, then I had an obligation to raise them properly. So they've told me four principles so far. Don't get angry. Don't tell him what to do about his drinking. Be determined that his drinking is not going to spoil your life. And don't set your heart on changing the person. And they acknowledge these suggestions are sometimes difficult. I mean, they are. But they say you will save many a heartbreak if you can succeed in observing them. So if my heart is broken over what someone else is doing, I can ask myself, which of these principles have I violated? Have I gotten angry and harbored resentment willfully? Have I been telling someone what they need to do about what I perceive as their issues? Am I letting what someone else is doing destroy my life? Well, then I've got an idol. And am I trying to set my heart on changing someone? Is that my life goal, to change a person? That's another idol. Of course, I can always hope, I can pray, but my heart needs to be set on one thing primarily, and that's God and doing his will and growing closer with him. Page 115, there's another principle, fifth principle. It says, you must be on guard not to embarrass or harm your husband. Remember, we're told back in chapter 6 that I have no right to save my own skin at another person's expense. So a good principle when we're doing 10 steps is if I have a resentment against Susie Q, I want to call someone who doesn't know Susie Q. I'm not going to call Susie Q's sponsor or a mutual friend. It's best as much as possible to do things with people who don't know the other person. I have no right to save my own skin at another person's expense. And then we get a promise there at the end of the second paragraph, page 115. It says, your new courage, good nature, and lack of self-consciousness will do wonders for you socially. So if I practice these principles, it tells me I'm going to get more courage. My fears are going to go away or at least lessen. I'm going to have a good nature because I'm not going to be so tense from trying to run the world. I'm not going to worry about what other people think about me. And of course, that will all help me be a better friend. Sixth principle, still on page 115. In dealing with kids and their father, it says it's best not to take sides in any argument he has with them while drinking. So the rule I always had with myself when my kids were little, and I mean, by the way, my husband didn't drink, but I had this rule for myself anyway, that unless my husband was doing something dangerous, I wouldn't interfere. Now, I think we have to be careful with the word dangerous because it can be loosely interpreted to mean anything I don't agree with. I mean, I thought taking them to like a fast food restaurant was dangerous, you know, half kidding here. But I'm talking about I should keep my mouth shut unless my husband did something genuinely dangerous, like leave him in the bathtub and went outside when they were 2 years old, which, of course, he never did. In hindsight, I should have kept my mouth shut a whole lot more. And they talk about something similar back at the beginning of the chapter. Page 106 says, we've tried to hold the love of our children for their fathers, which is an instinctive thing for a mom to do if she thinks her husband is doing everything wrong and that her kids won't love them. Many times, I'm sorry to say, when my kids were younger, I tried to manipulate relationships and think things like, okay, if I don't tell my husband to go outside and play basketball with Daniel, he's not going to have a good relationship with Daniel. And when Daniel grows up, he's going to remember my husband's neglect and not like him. Well, Daniel is now 21 and he adores my husband more than he adores me, who did so much more for him, in my opinion. Just kidding. My job is to let other people have their own relationships and not try to manage and control them, either to get people to love each other, or if I'm mad at one family member, to try and get the other family members on my side and mad at that person too. I have to let everyone have their own relationships. And now sometimes I'll pray and I'll ask God to bless the relationship between my husband and my daughter, my husband and my son and my daughter, my kids and I. I go through all the relationships that we have in our house and I pray for the people and the relationships. Okay, bottom of page 115, seventh principle. Don't lie on behalf of your husband in order to protect him. We are people who have to be honest, even if there will be consequences for another person. In the chapter to employers, it says, sometimes an employer may worry that the guy's drunk when his wife calls and says he's sick. And then it says, if he's trying to recover and he's drunk, he'll tell you about it, even if it means the loss of his job, for he knows he must be honest if he would live at all. We don't try to shield people from consequences by lying. And again, lying is the fastest way to keep God out of our recovery. So page 116, there's a little shift. It's like they're saying, okay, up until now, we've been talking about how to help your husband, but now let's talk about you. They say, we've elsewhere remarked how much better life is when lived on a spiritual plane. If God can solve the age-old riddle of alcoholism, he can solve your problem too. And I can just see a wife reading this. It's like, wait, what, me too? No, no, no. I was here to, you know, help the drunk I'm married to. And they're saying, me too? Like, no way, Jose. But they gently press on saying, we wise found, like everyone else, we were afflicted with pride, self-pity, vanity, self-centeredness, selfishness, and dishonesty. And at the bottom of page 116, they say, we used to think we were good women, capable of being nicer if our husband stopped drinking, right? It's like, I wouldn't be nasty if my husband did this, if my kids did this, if my boss did that. But remember, our recovery is never dependent on circumstances. It's always dependent on our relationship with God. If we're in the food, it's never because this person did this or that person did that. It's because I'm outside of God's protection. I've put myself outside of his protection, either by lying, by being in resentment, by not surrendering everything. It's never circumstances. And they say, okay, here's the solution. We try to put spiritual principles to work in every department of our lives. And if we practice the opposite would be humility, gratitude, unselfishness, honesty, and self-sacrifice. It tells us on page 117 that if we practice these things, God will give us a radically changed attitude toward our husband. God sees me. I matter to God. God himself will see the work I'm doing, even if my husband doesn't, and will radically rewire my heart. So as a result of applying these spiritual principles, it tells me the gifts that God will give me. Lack of fear, lack of worry, lack of hurt feelings. And then they tell me something that I don't really like. On page 117, it says, all problems will not be solved at once. The old problems will still be with you. This is as it should be. I mean, come on. This is as it should be. God's not going to wave like some cosmic magic wand and make all the problems go away as soon as I surrender to him and get through the steps. I mean, I'm just saying if I were God, I might do things a little differently. But I think I'm learning that whenever I go through a difficult situation in my own house, those difficult situations force me to rely on God more and more and force me to look at the idols in my life. Do I have an idol of the perfect marriage? That's what some of us do. Do I have an idol of perfect children who go to the perfect college? Do I have an idol of the perfect relationship with my children, which is what drove me for many years? I was often paralyzed with fear that when my kids grew up and were no longer under my control, that they wouldn't love me anymore. And that fear led me to alternate between being overly lenient to manipulate them into loving me and overly tough to retaliate when I didn't think they loved me right and did what I wanted. Happy to report that God is good. These relationships have been mended. And I have a really good relationship with both my kids now. But it took a lot of inventory work and amends and prayer. So here's the prayer I've used, which of course can be changed to fit anything that's too important in our lives. God, I entrust my children to you now. I release them to your protective care, knowing that they're much safer with you than in my clinging hands. Please remove all idolatry of my children and my relationship with my children from my heart, so that I don't endanger them or myself. Please remove all fear that I won't matter to them. I release my children to you, and I release my fear to you, so that I'm free to cling to your hand. Thank you that as I entrust my children to you, you are free to shower blessings on them. Thank you that your presence goes with them wherever they go. Thank you that you will guide my children and help them learn to trust you. Thank you that I matter to you. Thank you that your presence stays with me as I relax and trust you. Lord, I'm excited to watch and see what you will do. Amen. Okay, back in the book, page 117, they continue on and they say these workouts, meaning these difficult discussions we sometimes have, should be regarded as part of your education. You will make mistakes, but if so, this is a conditional promise, if you're in earnest, they won't drag you down. Instead, you'll capitalize on them. So first, these workouts, like difficult discussions. You know, sometimes people, when they do their inventory, and if someone's been unkind to them, they'll say, my part, and they'll look to make it their fault. But when the part is really failing to have a difficult discussion. Sometimes when we're in close relationships with someone, we have to say things to them like, I feel hurt by what you just said. Or, you know, it's not okay if you do what, like if you yell at me or whatever. We have to have difficult conversations. But it says, if we're in earnest, they won't drag you down, you will capitalize them. What does it mean to capitalize on my mistakes? Well, I don't think it means I'm ever going to be 100% free of things like fear and anger. Honestly, I don't think in this lifetime it's ever going to be 100%, at least not for me. But here's what can happen. Our bounce back period can get shorter. So where before, maybe I got a resentment or a fear and I was angry for 3 days or afraid for 3 days or so depressed I couldn't get out of bed for 3 days. Then maybe as I start working the steps, it's down to 2 days, then 1 day, then 2 hours, then 10 minutes. I don't always have it down to 10 minutes, but I can generally keep it to way less time than I used to. That's one way we can tell if we're growing spiritually, if our bounce back period is shorter. And then how do we capitalize on our mistakes? Well, the steps teach me that I need to look at my part. So if, for example, one of my kids was mouthing off to me and I got really upset, I don't stop with, she mouthed off to me. My part is I had an expectation that my children don't mouth off to me. I need to go deeper and look at the flaws in my makeup that cause it. So maybe I'm making an idol out of how much I matter to my children. We can tell something's an idol when our feelings aren't just hurt, when it feels like we got punched in the gut and can't get up. So I identify what my problem, what my idol is. I talk to someone who won't enable me. We know who those people are, the people we call and just say, oh, that's okay. You're only human. You're a mom. Yeah, your kids are difficult. Your husband's difficult. And we know the people who will say, go deeper. So we talk to someone and then we confess it and we repent. We say, God, I'm sorry. We ask him to remove the idol or whatever the defect is, remove the fear, remove the anger. And then we set about practicing the opposite. For me, the opposite of idolatry is true worship of God. The next principle, page 117, says, often you must carry the burden of avoiding resentments or keeping them under control. And in the margin of my big book, I wrote, it's not fair. And maybe it isn't fair, but it's loving. One of my close friends in recovery says, fairness is not my code anymore. Love and tolerance is my code. It's not fair that I did a whole bunch of really nasty, horrible things in my life, and God pulled me out of the gutter and gave me the great life I have. It's interesting. Whenever we say something's not fair, it's usually because something isn't fair to us, that we got the short end of the stick. Instead of saying, it's not fair that, well, 90% of the world lives in poverty, I have a pretty good life. That's not fair. But anyway, love and tolerance is our code. And what a great opportunity to practice love, self-sacrifice, which the book tells me to do. If someone utters a snarky remark, I try not to start an argument. I can absorb it and just let it go. That's a way of practicing self-sacrifice, which is necessary for my recovery. Now, again, that's not to say if someone's married to someone who's beating them, they're supposed to just take it. That's not what I'm saying. I'm talking about the occasional insensitive remark. Sometimes it's okay to just let things go. Next principle, page 118, the second full paragraph says, your husband knows he owes you more than sobriety. He wants to make good, yet you must not expect too much. I think there's two things for us here. One, if I don't expect too much, then I'm not disappointed. I'm always happily surprised. But also when it says he wants to make good, I think we're supposed to assume the best about people. People generally want to do the right thing. Maybe I'll be wrong, but isn't it better to assume the best in people rather than assuming the worst? That's how I want people to deal with me, and that's how we can build other people up. Next principle, page 119. When resentful thoughts come, try to pause and count your blessings. So we can intentionally look for our blessings, like I've got a job, I've got heat in my house in the winter, air conditioning in the summer, a husband who loves me and supports my recovery work and is actually making dinner now so that I could be on this meeting. And by the way, I don't believe to just put blessings on an app because my relationship isn't with my cell phone. My relationship is with God. So maybe I'll list them on an app, but then I'll say, thank you, God, for my husband. Thank you, God, for whatever it is. Because remember, we don't just want to list things like a grocery list. It's another way to build our relationship with God, to practice gratitude with him. Okay, a critical principle on the bottom of page 119, it says, find a great cause to live for. You probably need fresh interests as much as your husband and a great cause to live for. I mean, how lucky are we, right? We get to recover, we get to help others and get closer to God in the process. I can't think of a greater cause. And they tell us on the top of page 120 how to live that out. It says, think about what you can put into life instead of how much you can take out of it. So I could do this every place. Anywhere I go, I can think, what can I contribute here? Instead of what's in it for me? It's how can I best serve God and the people here? So maybe we're in the department store. We find a shirt that, you know, someone didn't put back on the hanger properly, and we just put it back. We're at the grocery store. When we put our cart away, we put a couple other carts away. Always, how can I contribute? And then finally, they talk about what happens if someone drinks again. And I love how they deal with this. On page 120, they say, perhaps your husband's made a fair start and things are going well, but then he gets drunk. What do you do? They say, if you're satisfied, he really wants to get over drinking, you need not be alarmed. So what they're telling us is that it's possible to really want to recover, but to stumble. Remember, in the forward to the second edition, it says that 25% of the original fellows who really tried recovered after some relapse. Imagine if they'd given up on that 25%. And by the way, I would have been included in that 25%. So they tell us not to be alarmed at the man's relapse. And they say it's infinitely better that he has no relapse at all, as has been true with many of our men. It's not a bad thing if the person sees he has to redouble his spiritual activities to survive. So they say it's better to have no relapse. I mean, there's a saying going around now that relapse is part of recovery. That is absolutely not true. It is better and it is possible for there to be no relapse. So what do you do to get out of relapse? It says redouble our spiritual activities, work the steps harder, more self-sacrifice for others, more time with God. Look to see if there are more things in our life that we haven't quite surrendered and surrendered them. More service, more love. And they tell us if he gets drunk, don't blame yourself. I am never the cause of someone else's drinking or binging, and no one else is ever the cause of mine. Okay, in the home stretch here, bottom of page 120, it says, God has either removed your husband's liquor problem or he has not. If not, it had better be found out right away. Then you and your husband can get right down to fundamentals. If a repetition is to be prevented, place the problem along with everything else in God's hands. Okay, there's a lot there and a lot that can help us as compulsive eaters. So let's try to break it down. It says, God has either removed your husband's liquor problem or he has not. So for us, God has either removed our compulsive eating problem or he has not. Well, what does that even mean? Is God up there in heaven flipping a coin? Heads, I'll remove Janet's eating problem. Tails, I won't. No, they're telling me that if God hasn't removed my food problem, I have not placed my food problem and everything else in his hands. Remember, chapter 4 tells us that either God is everything or he is nothing, meaning either give God everything or it's as if I give God nothing. I can't give him my food plan, but cheat on my husband or cheat on my taxes. So I think is to see what we haven't placed in his hands and then do it. That's what the fundamentals are. It makes me think of middle school social studies where we learned about like the king and the serfs. And as long as the serfs were on the king's land, then when the invading army comes to attack, the king pulls up the drawbridge. And if I'm on his land, I'm safe and protected. But if I wander off through dishonesty, lack of surrender, refusal to make amends, saying no one's going to tell me what to do, If I wander off, then when the invading army comes, I'm not on the king's land, safe and protected. Not because the king doesn't love me, but because I've wandered off. So they're telling us that we're liable to drink or eat compulsively if we basically wander off the king's land. But the good thing about this king is he will always take us back, and he will launch a search and rescue mission for us when we wander off. Okay, the final page of this chapter, page 121, the writers say, we realize this is hard stuff, but we really want to help you avoid unnecessary difficulties. And then they conclude by saying, good luck and God bless you. They are asking God, the creator, who like flung the sun, the moon, the stars, and everything, all the planets into place, to bless us. That means to confer his divine favor on us. And if we approach him in humility, he always will. Because whether we're wives living with raging alcoholics who feel unseen and unheard, or compulsive eaters who feel our lives are unmanageable and that no human power can save us, we matter. We always matter to God. And that's all I got. Thanks.
Hey, thank you, Janet, for sharing your experience, strength, and hope with us today. We'll now be transitioning into the question and answer segment. I'd like to introduce Kathy, who's our moderator today.
Thanks, Cheryl. My name is Kathy, and I'm a compulsive eater and the moderator for today. I have a few questions that have come in, but if you'd like to continue sending me your questions in the chat, feel free to do that. We'll try to get through as many questions as we can today. Thank you, Janet, for your share today. The first question says, what are some ways to improve our contact with God or our higher power?
Okay, so I don't know what step this person is on. So obviously, I would say getting through the steps, because the process, the whole process of the steps improves our conscious contact. And I would say time with God. It's like if someone's dating someone and wants to get to know them, they spend time. It's not just 10 minutes a day and then dash off and call if it's an emergency. Quality time with God. So I spend probably close to about an hour every morning in prayer, meditation, and spiritual reading. And I try to read things that excite my interest in God. In my prayer time, I include worship. So I start with, I'll sing a worship song or read some kind of praise, but starting with worship, because like God is worthy of worship. And then again, reading something with that makes me feel closer to God, that helps me learn more about God, love God more, realize his love for me more. Prayer and meditation, a lot of time. I'd say that's it. And also helping others, because when I'm transmitting this to others and talking to others about God, it makes it more alive and vibrant for me. Thanks.
Thank you, Janet. The next person writes, my question is around the word idol. How do you recognize an idol in yourself? How do you see them in others? Also, what can you do to change that type of delusion? For example, you said making my kids love me an idol. How do I get free of that?
Okay, so I think we can tell something's an idol if it's more important to us than our relationship with God. I think that's the easiest way to tell. Or if something feels like, if this ever happened, you know, something like that we just could never recover from it. But basically, something's more important than God. If I'm not doing God's will because of this, it's like, let's say I would know, like, I'm supposed to discipline my kids, but no, because of the fear. So what to do? Ask God to remove it, and we practice the opposite. So what that might look like in that situation is, see the dishonesty in my thinking. And the dishonesty in my thinking is, if I discipline my children, they won't love me. and then to do the right, do what I think God would have me, discipline them anyway. And I can report that, like, my children are not an idol in my life anymore. I'm happy that I have a good relationship with them. But if there was a time when one of my kids didn't speak to me for 6 weeks and she, you know, she'd said, I'm never talking to you again. And, you know, with a whole bunch of curses after that. And I was fine. So I think practicing the opposite and getting support from fellows, like letting people know what your problems are so they can support you. But God really can change our hearts. So I said that prayer I said was really helpful to me. Thanks.
Thanks, Janet. Somebody asked, you repeated early on one of your prayers about not loving others enough because you don't love God enough. Can you repeat that prayer or maybe even type it in the chat at some point?
Yeah, let me see if I can find it in my notes quickly. Lord, I see that I don't really love my children too much. I love you too little in proportion to them. Only if I love you supremely will I love everything else well and properly. Capture my heart. Amen. I didn't write that prayer. I read it and I just thought it was perfect.
Great. Thank you. The next question, you talked about enabling through the phrase, I'm only human. Can you explain that?
Yes, if I say that, then I'm letting myself off the hook, because if I'm have a resentment, if you know, if, or I'm not supposed to just say, well, I'm only human. I'm supposed to resolve my resentment. This program gives us spiritual power, that we have the power to resolve resentments. So I think generally it's a self-enabling statement.
Okay. Thank you for that. And along those lines, you also said falling off the bed, one of two ways, one is enabling, what is the other? And what would I be saying instead of saying I'm only human?
So I would say, I have a resentment. I need to resolve it. And I would look and see, what's my part? Oh, I'm being selfish. You know, I'm being entitled. And then I would resolve it. But I never say to myself, if I have a resentment, oh, I'm only human. Anyone would get angry in that situation. This book doesn't allow us that luxury. Now, other people may, earth people may, but that's not my business. I can't.
Great. Thanks, Janet. What literature do you read in the mornings?
So I do different. So first I looked up to see what the founders of AA read. So I read some of that stuff. I read the Bible and I'll, you know, I do different things, but sometimes I'll read the Bible and I'll pick a passage and I'll really like try and sink my teeth into it and meditate on it. There's an app I use. It's called Lectio 365. It's a 10-minute meditate. I'm Christian, so these are all Christian things. So if that's not your religion, you might not want to listen. Lectio 365, which is a good 10-minute app, like a warm-up. And I read books by Tozer. Moody has a book called Prevailing Prayer that I think is really good. There's a book called How to Pray, A Simple Guide for, I think, Normal People by Pete Gregg, Grieg. And there's like a prayer video that goes with that, like the prayer course, like a free YouTube series. So those are some of the things that come to mind.
Thank you, Janet. So that's all the questions that I've received in the chat today. So I am going to go ahead and turn the meeting back over to our chairperson, Cheryl. Thanks again, Janet.
Hey, thank you, Kathy. According to our seventh tradition, we're fully self-supporting through our own contributions. As we have now moved to virtual meetings, it's important that we continue to be fully self-supporting. This allows Overeaters Anonymous to continue to carry the message to those that still suffer. If you're able to send your donations through our website at www.AD4L.info. For those of you able to see the Zoom chat, the link will also be posted there. Thank you all for your support. It is appreciated. A reminder that a Design for Living Big Book OA is a daily meeting. We're based out of Melbourne, Australia. The recording from today's workshop will be available at our website, where you can also find out about other upcoming events and speakers. Visit our website at www.AD4L.info. Our next monthly speaker series will be held on Sunday, October 8th, 7:30 a.m. to 9 a.m. The topic is The Family Afterwards. We hope to see you there. In closing, I'd like to thank you all for your service and coming here today. By following the 12 steps, attending meetings regularly, and using the OA tools, we're changing our lives. You'll find hope and encouragement in Overeaters Anonymous. To the newcomer, we suggest attending at least 6 different meetings to learn the many ways OA can help you. The opinions expressed here today are those of individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. Please remember our commitment to honor each other's anonymity. What you hear here, whom you hear here, when you leave here, let it stay here. Let us all reach out by phone or email to newcomers, returning members, and each other. Together, we get better. To close the meeting, will Chris M. please unmute and read the promises that will be posted?
If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we're halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them.